the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning, my colleagues John Wells and Lynn Ware Peak speak with National Geographic science journalist and author David Quammen, who is releasing his 17th book, The Heartbeat of the Wild, Dispatches from the Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope.
And then we're joined in the studio by Daniel Butcher. He's the owner and CEO of IT Innovated. We'll be talking all things internet security, emerging technological threats, and what you can do to keep your technology safe.
These stories when we return.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our next guest is one of the most celebrated science writers of our time. David Quammen has written for National Geographic for 2 decades. In doing so, he's had a lifetime of adventure, travel, and observations of the wilds of nature over the entire globe. David is the author of 17 books, including his 2012 book, Spillover, which predicted a worldwide pandemic. It was shortlisted for 8 national and international book awards and won 3. He has joined us many times on Cool Science Radio, and we're so happy to have him back today to discuss his new book, The Heartbeat of the Wild, Dispatches from Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope. He joins us from Bozeman, Montana. David Quammen, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much, Lynn. John, it's nice to have a chance to talk with you again.
Well, thank you. We talked to you a couple of times, I think, during the pandemic, and you talked famously about how you didn't leave your house. You used, what was it, 1 tank of gas in like 2 years or something like that. You have revisited 21 stories, sort of rewritten, updated. Did The Heartbeat of the Wild lure you out of your library?
Well, I had already been long out of my library. This book, as you say, it's pulled together from 21 stories that I wrote for National Geographic over 20 years. So I did a lot of traveling for them. I was what they called a contributing writer, which meant I was on a contract for 3 feature stories a year. So I traveled for these stories, and they always tended to assign me stories that involved wild creatures in remote places, the science of these great ecosystems, the scientists who study them, and conservation efforts to preserve biological diversity. But these 21 stories are the basis of this book, but not the totality of this book. People sometimes say, well, it's a collection of 21 pieces, but it's more than that. I certainly hope it's more than that. I spent a lot of time, again, in my little office here in Bozeman, Montana, pulling this together as a cohesive book with a lot of updated reporting on the 21 different places and situations that I reported on earlier, on connective material, telling stories of how these stories came to be and how one assignment led to another, and then a new forward and an afterward, putting this whole body of investigation into a broader and I hope deeper context about the science of wildness, an understanding of what we mean when we say someplace is wild. So I really think of this book as a narrative manifesto on wildness and how we can save it on planet Earth.
Well, that definitely was the thread for me that stuck out, this talk about what wildness is. It made me ponder what it is even before I started reading. How do you define wildness?
Well, as I say in the introduction, it's not easy to define. Wildness is somewhat ineffable, a little bit subjective, I suppose you could say, but that's not to say, and intangible, but that's not to say it's not real. It's very, very real. To me, wildness is a name that we give to nature, to biological systems at their most robust, complex, diverse, unpredictable, and undiminished dynamic wildness. And that means a couple of things, and I discussed that in the introduction. If you put a tiger in a cage, in a zoo. Is that wildness? No, it's a wild animal. It's a dangerous animal. It's a magnificent animal, but it's not wildness in the sense that I'm talking about, because it's extracted from its context. Wildness has to include, I think of it as four things: scale, connectivity, diversity, and processes. By scale, I mean wildness has to be big. You can't have wildness in a little patch of plants and a few animals, not in the true sense of wildness. You need big predators, and to have big predators, you need big areas, you need big space. You need connectivity. Your wildness can't be chopped up into bits. You can't have roads going through it. You can't have it split into pieces. You need big contiguous areas. You need complexity. You need diversity, biological diversity. And of course, if you have those first two things, if you have scale and you have connectivity, those are the necessary ingredients to having biological diversity, full complete food chains, big predators, mesopredators, prey species, a diversity of insects, pollinators, et cetera. And that leads to the fourth thing that you need. You need processes, the processes of a richly diverse functional ecosystem: predation, competition, herbivory, photosynthesis, scavenging, parasitism, decomposition. You need all of that. And you put those things together and you have what I think it's legitimate to call wildness. And it still exists in a lot of places on planet Earth, but it is besieged, it is shrunken, it is precious, it is finite. And understanding that, as well as treasuring that, is what this book is about.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with David Quammen, who's just written The Heartbeat of the Wild: Dispatches from Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope. In addition to this conversation, you may want to take a peek at the Tangled Tree conversation we had in September 2018 and spill over the conversation we had in July of 2020. David, I wanted to ask you, who is Michael Fay? And what epic trek did he and you embark on?
This is where it all began for me. In 1999, I got a call from an editor at National Geographic. I had never worked for them before. I had never pitched a story to them. But I got a call from them saying, "Look, Quammen, we are about to embark on a big project. We're sponsoring an ambitious expedition across the last remaining forests of Central Africa, the Congo Basin and the Ogooué River Basin, an expedition conducted by an explorer, conservationist, and ecologist named J. Michael Fay. And he is going to walk through these forests 2,000 miles from the northeastern corner of the Republic of Congo across Gabon to the Atlantic Ocean, doing a biological survey of what's there in order to be able to plot, map, discover the really precious hotspots. Where's the greatest concentration of gorillas? Where's the greatest concentration of chimpanzees? Where's the greatest concentration of giant old growth trees, of forest elephants? He's going to survey all this in the course of this walk. And we're sponsoring it, National Geographic, and we want some stories out of it. We want a series of stories based on this trek. I'm turning off my email program right there. That was that slight distraction. And there's a great photographer who is going to cover this, a fellow named Nick Nichols. You know him. He's a friend of yours. And we want you to be the writer on this. And eventually I said yes. And Fay did this trip, which he called the Mega Transect, mega as in huge, transect as in a biological survey walk. He walked for 456 days on this zigzag route, and it was a zigzag route in order to stay as far as possible away from human presence in these forest blocks, staying away from roads, staying away from trails, staying away from villages, staying in the deepest part of the forest in order to see what wildness was there, what biological diversity was there, and also to sort of measure the gradient between human presence and absence of human presence, as that correlated with biological richness of diversity. So Nick Nichols and I, the photographer and I, followed him on stretches of this. He would need resupply about every 10 days or 2 weeks. And so we would come in and walk with him for a stretch, 10 days, 2 weeks. And I ended up walking with him for a total of 53 days, I think it was, over four different trips, and writing three stories based on that. And so those three stories were the beginning of my relationship with National Geographic magazine, and they're the beginning of this book.
For lovers of science, Lynn and I are pretty much low tech. I was also happy to hear that you're low tech as well. You do not have special clothing when you went on this trek. You had some very basic sandals, I believe. This is high tech. You used duct tape on your feet to take care of all your blisters and things like that. And as I believe that you taught Jane Goodall how to use duct tape because she had trouble with her feet. And you have a notebook and you have a pen and you don't have satellite radios. You're a low-tech guy.
I am a low-tech guy. Let's talk about that a little bit, and then we can come back to Jane. That's a separate story in this book. But Jane is a great character and a great friend. And it was interesting to take her into this particular forest area 2 years later. So I learned quickly on the trail with Mike Fay that long pants in any sort of fancy light expedition material and long sleeve shirts and hiking boots were inappropriate, terrible ideas, because we started off walking in the mud, and then we walked through the forest, bushwhacked through the forest, and then we walked through thorn thickets, and then we crossed swamps, and we walked through the mud, and at the edge of the mud was sand, and you put mud and sand inside your hiking boot, and you may as well be putting your foot inside an industrial sander. And so after about 3 days, I got rid of my long pants and I got rid of my hiking boots. And I went to what I had brought along as emergency measures, which was river sandals and river shorts, a t-shirt, a notebook, a ballpoint pen inside a Ziploc bag, a bottle of iodine, a little first aid kit that had Band-Aids in it, and a roll of duct tape. And we did literally plunge in neck deep, and we would hike and we would get sweaty and we would get muddy and we would go in knee deep and go in hip deep and cross these little black water streams and cross these muddy swamps. And finally, we'd get to a campsite near water, some kind of water, even if it was just a little trickle of a stream, 4 inches deep with mud on the bottom, but a little clear water. We would camp by that and we would drink that water. We drank the ambient water, the local water, wherever we went. And generally that worked fine because we were in places so wild that there were no humans upstream from us. So there were no human microbial threats in the water. So we drank the water out of the stream. We washed in the stream after a day of hiking and getting sweaty. And we'd eat a very simple meal. And then I would crawl into my little tent and zip it closed and go to sleep warm and dry and wake up at 4:30. I would still be clean and dry. I would spread iodine on all the cuts and scratches and gouges on my feet and my shins. And then I would take Band-Aids and peel off the little smooth paper that you find on a Band-Aid and use that as sort of a sterile patch on all the sores, wounds on my feet. And then I would tape with duct tape over the little patches of smooth paper. So when I pulled the duct tape off, I wouldn't rip open the wound. And I found a certain kind of duct tape that worked really well on one's feet. I would duct tape my feet, then I would put on my sandals and my shorts, climb out of the tent, and dawn would occur. We'd have a cup of coffee and a little simple bit of breakfast, and we'd start to walk again. And it worked well. It worked well. And then 2 years later, we took Jane Goodall into one of these very, very wild places to meet a group of chimpanzees that were so remote and so naive to humans that they weren't afraid of humans. on the original trek, they had approached us. They had been curious. They had come down to us. They had followed us. And that was in an area that needed preserving. It wasn't part of a national park. So we took Jane in there, bringing the spotlight of her international fame on that very special place called the Guologo Triangle in the Republic of Congo. And it eventually did become preserved. But in the course of going in there, 12 kilometers of walking through the swamps, Jane's feet got pretty beat up. And she said, when we finally got to camp, David Q, you do this thing with duct tape on your feet. Would you duct tape my feet? So the first morning that we were there, I duct taped Jane's feet and gave her my spare roll of duct tape. And then for the rest of the time, she was quite capable of duct taping her own feet each morning.
Wow, that must have felt like a huge honor to educate the likes of Jane Goodall, who has spent decades in these areas on how to.
I'm duct taping Jane Goodall's feet, and I feel a little bit like, without being profane, I felt like, you know, Mary Magdalene washing the feet of Jesus with her and drying it with her hair.
Well, there are probably few places left on Earth where the four elements of wildness can be achieved. Just for the sake of time, I want to move from Africa over to Chile and Argentina, where Doug and Christine Tompkins preserved that incredible swath of land, over 700,000 acres. And the conservation there, it really meets the definition of wildness, doesn't it, in all ways? And I'm always so baffled by how they did it, how they bought little bits at a time without it really being noticed until it was so big that the Chilean government was kind of freaking out about it.
Yes, this is a great story of conservation heroism. Doug Tompkins and Chris Tompkins each made their fortunes in the clothing business. Doug Tompkins was in the late 60s. He was, you know, a go-boy adventurer, climber, kayaker, et cetera, et cetera. Went down to Patagonia with a couple of his buddies, one of whom was named Yvon Chouinard, later the founder of Patagonia. And Doug fell in love with the Patagonia area, southern Chile. And he ended up founding North Face, the North Face company, and then also Esprit. And Christine, whom he met later, became CEO of Patagonia. And the two of them eventually cashed out and said, we want to do something more meaningful than make piles of money. And he had moved first to down to Chile, and she met him, and they were married and became partners in this effort of buying up wild land and also some derelict old ranches and rewilding those ranches, putting together, in order to get scale, which I've talked about, putting together pieces of wildness and potential wildness and giving those lands to the people of Chile to be preserved as national parks. So they did that in a number of places, more than a dozen places, I think now, in Chile and then also in Argentina, including the great Ibarra wetlands of northern Argentina that became a provincial park, Ibarra, a provincial and national park, where they are restoring jaguar, restoring populations of giant anteater, restoring other species. And Doug tragically died in a kayaking accident about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more than that now. And Chris has carried on doing this. I asked her when I spent time with her down there for the National Geographic piece at the very end of the time. She was headed off next morning to see another piece of land, flying with her pilot in a little plane to explore a piece of wild land on the side of a mountain. And I asked her, Chris, when does it end? And she said, it doesn't, not until I kick the bucket. So that's the kind of unpretentious, hardy, relentless, dedicated spirit that these two, Doug and Chris Tompkins, brought to protecting great wild places in the southern cone of South America.
It's just an incredible story. I'm really happy to hear that she has continued in this endeavor.
Yes, she is. And the interesting story, how she began her career with Patagonia. She grew up as kind of an outdoorsy girl, on a ranch in Southern California. When she was about 15 or 16 years old, there was a guy who was occupying a house nearby, and he had a garage, and he was making equipment, climbing equipment, with his own sort of blacksmith forge. And his name was Yvon Chouinard. And he was about to start a company, originally the Black Diamond Equipment Company. She was 16 and she wanted a job. So she asked him if she could have a job. And he said, yeah, okay, you can work for me. Start cutting climbing ropes. So she was cutting climbing ropes for Yvon Chouinard in his garage for about $1.40 an hour when she was 16 years old. Spin the clock forward and she is CEO of the Patagonia Company.
David, the cover picture of your book has a mature male lion, beautiful lion. And as I read further into your book, you tell the story of this lion. His name is Seaboy. And he lived until he was 14, which actually is pretty good for a male lion. Can you talk about his story a little?
Yes, yes. And I'm delighted to have that photograph on the cover of this book. It's the only photo, although this is a National Geographic Books publication, it's the only photograph in this book. The rest is my words. But this photograph taken by my partner on the Megatransect, Nick Nichols, a wonderful working partner and dear friend that I did a number of stories with. This particular photograph, as you say, John, is not just any lion. This is a very particular individual lion, a lion that we got to know well and to care about when we did a story together on lions of the Serengeti National Park, this great savanna ecosystem in Tanzania. And Nick spent about 6 months there living out of a camp in the backcountry of Serengeti. I made two trips to work with him and a scientist named Craig Packer, a great lion biologist from the U.S. who had studied the Serengeti lion for about 30 years at that point. And with Craig Packer's team, we learned the individuals that they knew. Some of them were collared individuals, some were not, but they followed these individuals and learned their stories and patched together the ecological realities of a lion on the Serengeti. And one of the ecological realities that I learned very quickly from Craig Packer is the primary cause of death, the number one cause of death for lions in a wild ecosystem, and that is other lions. It's dangerous being a lion because you live amid lions. And this particular lion, Seaboy, had almost died in an event when four males from another group came, cornered him, and were trying to kill him. And one of Craig Packer's researchers was there in a Land Rover observing this, and she thought this was the end for Seaboy. They hurt him badly, surrounding him, attacking him from all sides. Eventually, he limped away and survived and established a territory somewhere else with his partner, male lion. A Lothario was good when it was mating time, but very bad when it was time to fight against a group of other lions. He established a new territory, a new life, lived on, and he was there when we got there, and we followed him. He was a magnificent creature. Nick photographed him. I told his story in the article. And eventually, about five years later, we got news that Seaboy had died. His carcass had been found and recognized by a guide, cause of death unknown, but the word got back to us at National Geographic. And the photo editor there, Kathy Moran, said, David, why don't you write an epitaph for Seaboy? So I wrote another story about Seaboy that went up on the National Geographic website with this photograph. So it's a very special photograph.
Several years ago, Lynn and I did an interview about crows, and one of the things we learned was that crows and human beings are the only two animals that they believe premeditate a murder, that think about it, that plan it ahead of time. It almost sounds like this lion mafia that's moving around of three or four lions. Was it instinctual on their part, or was there a plan? Were they planning these things?
Wow, that's a very interesting question, and it's probably impossible for me to answer. It might even be impossible for Craig Packer to answer. I'm fascinated with the question, partly because I love crows too. I have high respect for the intelligence of crows. They have senses of humor. They have sophistication. They have a capacity to play. It doesn't surprise me that scientists have discovered they have a capacity to premeditate a murder. I don't know if lions are as smart as crows, but they may well be. But it is also instinctual for a group of male lions. The social structure of lions is that females live together in prides of sisters and mothers and aunts, related females, and they jointly protect their cubs. And occasionally they mate with males who occupy the territory in which they live. So the males may occupy a large territory, and there may be more than one pride of females in that territory if they're greedy for mating opportunities, which they certainly instinctively are. The males fight with one another for those territories and for the rights to mate with those females. So even when, after Seaboy had established a new territory with his partner, the killers were still visiting. There was and patrolling through that area, sort of making brazen incursions and into Seaboy's territory, threatening that they might want to take over that territory too. And one night we followed the killers on one ramble through Seaboy's territory. One of them had a radio collar that we could track. One of the researchers, a Danish fellow named Daniel, and I followed them in a Land Rover through the night with the help of the radio signal and with night vision goggles. And we just tracked them all night, and we would take turns. They would bed down and we would stop the Land Rover. We were following them within about 40 or 50 feet. They knew we were there. They didn't care. We followed them with the Land Rover. They would stop. We would sleep. We would take turns driving, take turns staying awake to watch and see when they moved again. And we followed them all night to see whether they would find Seaboy and try and kill him again. And eventually dawn came, and they ambled their way back out of Seaboy's territory. And we saw them off, and then we went to sleep. But it was a very, very interesting night, the night of the long follow.
Wow. What a story, and what a book. It's called The Heartbeat of the Wild, Dispatches from Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope. Our guest is David Quammen, who we're so happy joined us again. David, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
You're very welcome. I always enjoy talking with you guys. It's a pleasure, and thanks for your interest.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
As our dependence on technology grows, along with more and more time on these devices, so do threats to our systems, data, and devices. Joining us to talk about these threats and how we can protect ourselves from these ever-changing issues is Dan Butcher, owner and CEO of IT Innovated. Dan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, IT Innovated is a sponsor of Cool Science, so thank you for that. Tell us a bit about your company and what services you provide.
So my company, we basically supply or provide anything from technology from your computers to your servers to your network. So we could build anything from basically where the line comes in from for the internet to the router to servers to anything down to a tablet. So anything technology wise is what we handle.
Before we started, we were discussing all things security related, and I think a lot of us, you know, we hear about these massive hacks for, you know, hospitals or airlines. I've just got my little computer at home. Do I need to worry about internet security?
Absolutely, you do. Yes. So I figure everything is like a house, basically. So if your house has got locks on your doors, you got everything like that. So picture your computer as a house. So put your locks on your doors, put your cameras on the outside of your house. Basically pretend like your house is your computer. And that's how I kind of figure things out that way. So.
Yeah, well, Dan, thanks for being here with us and in the studio. It's nice to have you up. And as an underwriter, or you help us here at KPCW with yes. our internet security and our IT in general. And I think that, you know, as a
when I think about lay people out there and individuals out there, like Katie said, I just have a little computer and there's nothing much else that I might need other than changing my passwords and maybe get a virus scan, a subscription to a virus scan. And so I wanted to talk to you about that. We were talking in the green room about these subscriptions, and I told you a subscription that I have, and I'm quite certain it doesn't actually do anything.
Yes.
And Katie was talking about one that she has, and you said, oh yeah, that's actually a good one. So what should we as consumers, as individuals, be doing?
So when you buy a computer, it always comes with a free trial of antivirus, and it only lasts a few months. So after that, then you get all these add-ons that keep popping up. And so basically, the first thing I would do when you get a computer is I would actually uninstall that free antivirus and then put on your own antivirus. And if you're within a company, I would suggest, like my company, use that company for the antivirus and have them handle all the antivirus needs.
Okay, so I, as an individual, would call up IT Innovate and say, I just got a new computer. I need it protected. So do you have your own virus scan that you would install on my computer, or do I bring my computer, you know, do you log on to my computer and do it for me?
Yes. So yeah, I would log on to it. We have remote capabilities and we could just push out all the antivirus to it. So it's literally a push of a button and we send it to your computer. So.
Wow. So on this antivirus, is this software that you have developed within your company or are you licensing it through someone else?
It's licensed through somebody else through an actual program that I use. It's called RMM.
Wow.
So remote monitoring. Wow. Is what it is. So.
I know another thing that we were talking about is, password managers. You know, Lynn was saying that, you know, she's got a few that she chooses from. And I'm very neurotic about having a password manager that continually updates my passwords, changes the passwords. Mm-hmm. What is the importance of making sure that our passwords are safe? I mean, you know, I think I have probably over 100 sites that I go to that require passwords.
Absolutely, yeah. So password managers are great to have. I mean, but at the same time, lately, they're getting hacked, like the actual big password manager. I forgot the name of the latest one that's been hacked, but I would suggest right now kind of steering away from password managers and using more of like a document and putting it on there and then saving it onto an external hard drive off of a computer.
So. Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So the old even printing it out and taping it to the underside of your desk, you know, something like
yeah,
that might be safer than an actual password manager.
I wouldn't suggest under a desk, but I would suggest onto a like external hard drive and make sure it's not plugged into the computer until everybody can figure out the hacking situation with the password manager's software that's going on right now.
Well, this is very interesting. As we were talking about, I haven't done a password manager because something sounds suspicious to me about a password manager. And yet then I leave myself exposed with my four favorite passwords that I rotate through sites, and
yeah,
which is extremely time consuming because you can never remember which of those four passwords you've entered. And so you go through, oh no, that's not the right, you know, the number of times and the amount of times that people probably like me have to reset their password
because
they forgot it. I mean, overall, Dan, when are we going to be doing away with passwords in general? Is it in our future, our near future?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, a lot of computers, the newer ones, have facial recognition, and of course, some of the older ones too have like the thumbprint. So, I mean, I could see it going away in the future for sure.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with Dan Butcher, owner and CEO of IT Innovated. I got an iPhone for the first time last year. Yes, a little bit of a Luddite with that.
Oh, and you switched from a droid?
I did.
Yes, there you go.
Join the dark side. And I set up the facial recognition.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little weird to get used to it, but now I love it. How secure is that? I do know there's the thing that if your eyes are closed, let's say you've been knocked unconscious and someone steals your phone, they apparently can't hold your phone to your face. How secure really is that facial recognition system, though?
Really secure. Yeah, really secure. Like I said, with the eyes closed, it definitely won't work. And late with the pandemic, everybody had the mask on. You can actually open your phone up, but then the iWatch actually came out with something so that you can actually open your phone with your iWatch. So it's pretty interesting, but I would say that it's very secure with the facial recognition because it makes you scan yourself a million times in different angles. So
yeah,
no one's gonna really have the same facial structure and everything like that as any of you would.
Wow. So I know one of the things with your business is the actual infrastructure mm-hmm. for IT, and you work typically with large corporations like KPCW. Going back to my one little computer in my little house,
yes.
What sort of physical infrastructure do I need to really think about to keep my systems not just safe, but functioning well and functioning long-term?
So I would start with your home network. I'd make sure that you have your firewall or your router completely secured out. So going through your internet service provider, I'd make sure that they have nice security with built in those equipments. And then from there, I would make sure that your computer has, again, antivirus and that all the updates are ran periodically. So we call it Patch Tuesday. I mean, every time that updates come out, it's on a Tuesday. So make sure that you run your updates every Tuesday.
That's good. I think many people forget or overlook, or you're yes. right in the middle of something and that update notification pops up and you yes. say, remind me later. And then 2 weeks later, they're still reminding you.
Yes.
But you're always in the middle of something really crucial and a crisis. In terms of, you know, when you go into businesses, for example, an organization like KPCW or a small organization, but what do you see as the number one thing that small companies or even large companies are doing wrong with their networks, with their systems, and with their security?
I would say using the same password for everything. Because if somebody gets a hold of that same password, they can get into any of your systems. So I would suggest changing out your password every 90 days. If a computer, any of the computers within the company have actual facial recognition, I would use that. And going back to the network as well, making sure the firewall and all that is secure and is always scanning throughout the network to make sure there's no threats.
Many people sit in public spaces and log on to
yes.
the network at Starbucks mm. or at the library or wherever. There's always some sort of warning, I think, that pops up that
yes.
says, you know, don't be transferring bank funds or whatever on this
yes.
public. But how real is that threat and what can happen?
It's very real. So if you're at a Starbucks, they don't have too many security measures, especially if you're on a guest network, because guest network's wide open. So you could have a hacker sitting right next to you, and then all of a sudden, bam, you're getting hacked. You're getting all your stuff taken away. And also anywhere else. I mean, if somebody's monitoring that guest network, they can hack it as well from anywhere in the world. So I would suggest not doing any of that stuff on a guest network.
Well, a part of my virus security systems offers a VPN, a virtual mm-hmm. private network.
Yes.
Does that actually help deter hackers when you're in a public setting like that? Or am I just fooling myself that I'm safe to peruse the internet on the Starbucks website
no.
or the Starbucks internet?
So with a VPN, yeah, it's just basically a tunnel from where you're at to basically the place that you're a business or your home. So if you have a VPN, it's basically just a secure connection to that. So you really aren't too secure with the VPN, considering it's just a tunnel, but it's better than not having one at all when you're on a guest network, I would say.
Okay, and nothing against Starbucks, nothing against the Starbucks
yeah,
internet.
Just using them for example.
One of the things we were also talking about ahead of time was backup. I mean, I used to carry everything around on a little spare hard drive, including my graduate thesis that one day decided to die before I submitted it.
Yes.
Thank goodness I'd emailed yes. everything. And that was a very tough lesson in backing up the backups and the backups. So
mm-hmm.
I have a continual cloud service, Backblaze. It's always updating my computer.
Nice. Yes.
I've got my Apple, where I plug my other big Terra Drive hard drive in once a week, and it backs up everything off that. And I also have a Google Drive where I save a lot of my important files.
Smart,
am I doing enough?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that sounds like plenty enough. Yes. Again, a lot of backups are going to the cloud right now. And again, the clouds are getting hacked as we speak. And they're trying to figure out ways to prevent that. And so the way you're doing it is good. But I would steer away from the cloud for right now. And then I would just do local backups and take those like out of your house, or if you're out of business, away from the business and put them separately somewhere else.
Okay, we need to do a deeper dive on this, because when I grow up, I want to be like Katie and have it all organized.
She's doing it great.
But I'm here to just admit and to represent the rest of the population who just, you know, lets everything go to the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the other thing? I don't back anything up physically on an external drive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 101 backup. What should we be doing if not backing up to the cloud? Is Google Drive? Do we need Dropbox? What do we need?
Those at the same time are clouds as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard. I mean, I would do the research on basically what cloud services are being hacked as we speak. And I would go with the ones that haven't been, and I would shoot for that one. But in the meantime, I would definitely do like the hard drive backup and make sure you're doing it periodically, and take it off site somewhere and have one on site as well. Mm. So
that's very interesting.
It's crazy how we're going from this new cloud area to going back to old school stuff and doing it to a physical drive. But lately I've been seeing so much with the cloud being hacked. It's kind of crazy to put all of your eggs in one basket with that.
Right. How do you as a business, IT Innovated, see and find new hacking techniques, you know, things that maybe you haven't seen before that are becoming pervasive?
All about the research. I'm always researching everything as far as hacking goes, seeing what the next step is. I mean, if you think about it, everything is basically a computer nowadays. I mean, down to your refrigerator is a computer. So, I mean, your car is basically a computer nowadays. And if you buy a new car, it's a computer. So, really, your car can get hacked. Your refrigerator can get hacked. It's pretty crazy. So, you got to stay on top of what you're looking at as far as, I mean, security-wise. So that's what I do. I just research, and keep up on it. So
I'm sure that your vocabulary level in terms of IT security is a lot more advanced than the rest of us.
Yes.
So where can our regular listeners go to get more, like, what are some good sources and sites for security information?
I would say, actually, YouTube. I mean, as simple as that may seem, there's a lot of great videos out there that have actual, I would look actually first YouTube and then look at the reviews on actually what they're talking about and say, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Oh yeah, this is legit. And actually get your research through there. So
I bought a new computer last year, or not a computer, sorry, a printer, mm-hmm. and was reading up about printer security and how mm-hmm. my printer could be hacked, and how I need to continually update my printer. I'm like, what else?
Yes.
So how, aside from our computers and our fridges, what other devices in our homes we wouldn't think about having security patches on or updating on a regular basis mm-hmm. do we need to actually pay attention to?
I would look at your security cameras if you have any, because that's a big one. You don't want anyone staring at you. I mean, I was like last year, they had the Nest cameras get hacked, and there were people actually talking to the kids on the Nest camera, and it was really scary. Like, some guy would be on there and be like, hi, and like no one's around. And so I would definitely look at your security cameras for sure. Your computers, I mean, make sure your internet service provider, like I said earlier, is definitely has all the security patches on it. And really, just anything technology-wise, as you look around your house, if it's there, I would make sure it's up to date. And even hardware-wise, I mean, if it's old, I'd say update it.
There is a certain element of, I guess it's not paranoia, it's awareness that you have to have when you engage in, you know, having smart controls on your refrigerator. Mm-hmm. I don't have smart controls on any appliances. I don't have, I should say, you know, on air here that I do have home security, but
yes, she's got it all.
Yeah, got it all. Just you wait. But and it's for that reason. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get hacked. I don't want to have some hacker speaking to my children through my Nest. Yes. That's horrific. Scary. It's really scary. And so what is your opinion as a person who is, you know, steeped in technology? What do you say to people about having smart controls, you know, on your thermostat or your fridge? Do we really need all that?
I mean, it's the new ways. I mean, the actual thermostats of the olden days are going away. I mean, the ones with the little screens and the ones you have to actually press the buttons instead of doing it from your phone. So really, it's really can't get out of going the old school way. I mean, it's all going to go to the way of the Nest thermostat and any of the Nest stuff. So you just really got to make sure, even like the Nest thermostat has updates. I mean, your Nest cameras have updates. Everything has updates. So just make sure everything is updated.
It's funny. There was through the city a handful of years ago, you could get a rebate on your Nest thermostat. Mm-hmm. So I got one, and you know, I went from the old school and upgraded to the Nest and programmed it all in, and none of the programming worked. It didn't take the heat down in the middle of the night. It didn't detect when I was out of the house or when I was in the house. And it ended up, you know, it was supposed to be this huge savings on your heat bill, and it ended up costing me more because on my programmable old school thermostat, it was easy to program. It did the right thing. It didn't have to detect this or that or the other. It just turned it down to 60 or whatever in the middle of the night.
And like ego mode is what it is.
Exactly. And it just, I had to laugh both at myself, but also at this new world of technology that sometimes doesn't work for us either.
Yeah, it's taken over. Technology really is. Everything's going to be a computer, and it's kind of scary if you think about it. So, I mean, then you got AI taking over. So, I mean, if like say like an election's going on and someone does a deep fake is what I call it, and I think everybody else calls it that, but say a deep fake of like Donald Trump or something, or any of the presidents or any candidate saying, hey, like something really bad before a campaign. I mean, you really have to like stare at the screen to make sure it's really them, or really listen to make sure it's really them. So technology's insane.
Well, I think it's fascinating that we're talking about the best ways to save all your passwords, a piece of paper, maybe not taped onto your desk. And so the further along we get in these higher technologies, the more rudimentary we have to have as backups. And thinking about, you know, a Nest thermostat, I don't want a Nest thermostat in my house. I want a good old-fashioned one. But as these evolve, these technologies are becoming more and more complicated and more connected to the phones. But do you foresee other companies saying, you know what, no, here's the good old-fashioned thermostat that you actually have to manually turn up and turn down? Because it seems like, I know myself, I do not ever want a smart fridge. I don't want one more thing connected in my life. So do you foresee maybe a recreation of the good old-fashioned manual?
Yeah, I could see that happening for sure. But it's going to be more of your Nest stuff.
Okay.
It's going to be more of your actual sync to your phone. And, oh, I'm cold. I'm going to actually turn the heat up through my phone. So that's what the whole technology is shooting for. But I could see a few companies staying with the older stuff.
So back to your companies. We've got the Nest and these little technologies that are very, you know, internet connected for our personal lives. Are there big developments coming in for big corporations, such as the Nest for a company, where they're going to actually have to have this technology put onto 200 phones for their employees? And if so, what kind of hazards does that bring beyond just the shared password?
Yeah, it brings a lot of hazards, I would say. Yeah, because if your company is forcing, I mean, any of that kind of stuff, they better have something backing it to make sure it's safe. So I feel like I'm reiterating myself, but I'm just saying have that company make sure that everything is updated. And because if they're going to push it out, they got to back it up with security. So,
yeah. Well, we have just a few minutes left, and maybe we'll ask you, Dan, to just let us know, you know, what the most current threats are, what we should be looking for. You know, it could even be in, you know, whatever world of hacking that we're seeing now, things that are sort of ubiquitous but maybe subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that comes to mind for you?
Yeah. I mean, ransomware is always going to be there. So, I mean, you look at a lot of different ways of ransomware and people actually hacking in, grabbing all your files, and then basically wanting money for them. And most companies can't pay for that. So all of their data is lost immediately. And I think the lowest I've ever heard somebody actually apply for like a ransomware is like $4 million for all their company files to be taken back. And if you're a smaller company, you can't pay that $4 million, no way.
Is there insurance that companies take out for that sort of thing, to pay ransomware?
Yes, there is, but most insurance companies won't do it because it's just too high.
Yeah, and they probably say to the company, well, there are so many breaches that so many things that you didn't, you know, dot your I's and cross your T's.
Yes.
On security. It's not our fault, it's your fault.
Exactly, they go back and they look through every single thing to make sure that you did everything, and if you didn't, then they won't do it, they won't pay for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I would say look for, as far as security-wise, I do your MFAs, your multi-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you do that, even if it's two of them. I mean, do your like codes through your phone every time you log into something. And
so multi-factor authentication would be like a VPN?
It's more
of... Or that's dual factor?
More of like if you're going through your email and you log into your email, it's going to throw you to another place to put in a code. And so you want to have that second layer to throw in that code. Then you'll be able to access your email or whatever program that is.
Okay. So. Dan Butcher, IT Innovative. We're out of time. Thank you so much for supporting
for
this program.
Me.
And yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.